the seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras-Inglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable. And it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohammed Abu Selmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe... This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Somalia and the Somali government is quite upset about that particular arrangement and the kind of regional, big macro-regional shift I had talked about between Ethiopia and some of its neighbors in Egypt.
That was Michael Wildamari. I'm an expert in defense issues in the Horn of Africa at the University of Maryland, talking about Somaliland. Details coming up. Also, the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council warns of a growing crisis in Sudan, and the International Crimes Court is investigating possible human rights violations in Libya. These stories and more on African News Tonight. In Somaliland, the leader of the opposition Wadaani Party, Abdirahman Mohamed Abdullahi, known as Iro, recently was elected president of the self-declared republic. I spoke with a regional security expert about Somaliland and its position in the Horn of Africa. Here's more from our conversation. Michael Wildamari, an expert in defense issues in the Horn of Africa, says Somaliland opposition leader Mohamed Abdullahi's election as president shows that the breakaway region has built a stable political environment. That is in contrast to Somalia's security struggles. Wildamari is an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland near Washington, D.C., and a senior fellow at the Center for International and Security Studies. He says, amid the autocracies in the region, the self-declared Republic of Somaliland could come to be seen as a potential stabilizer.
Somaliland, not for the first time, has held successful democratic elections. It not for the first time will see an incumbent party turned out of power. And that, I think, is a real credit to Somaliland, its institutional development, and the stability that corner of the Horn has been able to cultivate over a number of decades.
Wildamariam said it has not been easy for Somaliland to get to this particular democratic outcome. In past elections, he says, there was a lot of rancor and haggling over the country's electoral process. However, they have managed to build a consensus around elections and have held what appears to be a very democratic ballot.
The incumbent, Musi Bihi, has accepted the result and will cede power. This is no small thing, of course, given what we've seen across the region in the past, and again, of course, you know, common practice across the African continent. I mean, incumbents often don't go willingly. So again, it's a big credit to Somaliland, and hopefully, you know, can be a rare bit of good news that the region more broadly can capitalize on.
There will be big questions to the new administration moving forward. Although it has been effectively autonomous since 1991, no other country has recognized Somaliland as an independent government, and it is still considered to be a region of Somalia. However, Ethiopia has indicated it will recognize Somaliland's independence in return for being able to set up a naval base and port in the region's coast.
As many of your listeners know, Somalia and the Somali government is quite upset about that particular arrangement and the kind of regional, big macro-regional shift I had talked about between Ethiopia and some of its neighbors in Egypt was really catalyzed by the MOU. A new government in Somalia is going to have to work through that particular issue. The early signs are that President Iro will take a close look at that particular agreement, is probably inclined to continue to support it, but we'll take a look at it and analyze it and come to their own kind of view on that particular arrangement.
Wildamariam says the new government will have to find ways to implement that agreement and to manage the regional fallout while Somaliland continues its quest for international recognition.
Mm-hmm.
A year and a half of war has spawned a relentless countdown to a near collapse in Sudan as more than 20 million suffer from raging violence, hunger, and forced displacement, according to Norwegian Refugee Council Secretary General Jan Egeland, who spent the past week in Sudan. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam he saw the ravages of war in Darfur.
Spent the last 2 days in Darfur, in West Darfur, in El Geneina, which was one of the places where this massive ethnic cleansing took place, and hundreds of thousands of people fled from there here into Chad.
Describe what you saw and what people told you there in Darfur and now El Geneina.
Well, in El Geneina, you see every sign of this horrific war, the horrific violence, and the horrific removal of an entire ethnic group, the Masalit. Our own office, Norwegian Refugee Council's office, was burnt, destroyed, looted. We were in an area where there were a lot of attacks and where the civilian population was also driven away and towards Chad. So I saw home after home destroyed. But I also saw people tentatively returning to try to rebuild. And the Norwegian Refugee Council has a large aid program in Darfur now. With support from USAID, we are providing subsidized, free, at very low price bread every morning to hundreds of thousands of people through nearly 500 bakeries.
A little bit of good news goes a long way for a place like Sudan.
But of course, I mean, the strongest impression I have after having spent now a week in and around Sudan, I was also on the East Coast in Port Sudan, is that this is indeed the biggest drama on our watch. It's the biggest humanitarian crisis, the biggest displacement crisis. 14 million people have been driven out of their homes. It's the biggest hunger crisis. Some 20 million people need food aid. I remember 20 years back when I was the UN humanitarian chief, we got President Bush, we got Prime Minister Blair in the United Kingdom, we got the European Union to have it on the highest levels of government to do whatever they could to help Darfur. Today, the crisis is three times that, and we're not even close to having the attention and the aid and the peace efforts that are needed.
When it comes to the peace efforts that are needed, I just talked to a person that is have met with the Sudanese officials there this past week. Even though they're not at the negotiating table, he's believing that the Sudanese army officials will be willing to come to the table and talk ceasefire. Do you feel like that's even a prospect on the horizon?
It's not very likely, no. All indications are that all sides in this war, there are many armed actors, that all sides still believe they have more to achieve through violence, an armed struggle. But I'm glad that the United States, the United Kingdom, Norway, some Gulf countries are trying to get peace talks again. We hope they will succeed. And in the meantime, let's at least have maximum pressure to stop the arms flow, to stop the support for armed actors, to stop the fuel to the fire, which is brought from international actors.
That's Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from N'Djamena, the capital of Chad. The South African government has not yet put together a plan to rescue hundreds of illegal miners thought to still be underground without food and water. This has left family members angry and human rights lawyers threatening legal action for supplies to be sent underground. Tusokumalo reports from Stilfontein, Northwest Province, South Africa.
The Lawyers for Human Rights group has criticized the government for dragging its feet in rescuing the illegal miners who have spent weeks in an abandoned gold mine in Stilfontein, Northwest Province. The miners refuse to leave the mine because they are afraid they will be arrested. The human rights lawyers say they are puzzled that police stopped community volunteers as they began a rescue mission, even though the government has no other plan in place. Mamekwe Sebei, an attorney with the lawyers group, says the police ban on sending food and water to the miners cannot be allowed to continue.
Now, we are considering a number of options, obviously, to ensure that we save life. I think that's what people need to understand. Every hour and every day that we waste is a life that is going to be lost needlessly.
Relatives of the miners are unhappy. Tande Gazinzi Tom says she is having sleepless nights about the fate of her brother Ayanda, who is underground.
I don't think it's by choice, but the government has failed us. My brother, I can confirm to you that he has a diploma in financial economics and accounting, but where he is now.
Mining companies have abandoned scores of mines in South Africa after they became unprofitable. However, thousands of people sneak into old mines to extract the remaining ore. The government bans unofficial mining, citing safety reasons and the loss of revenue from the minerals sold. The Northwest Provincial Government says that out of 1,259 illegal miners who have been arrested since August in the province, 871 are Mozambicans, 343 are Zimbabweans, 33 Lesotho nationals, and only 10 are South Africans. Zimbabwean national George Dube, who also openly says he goes there to make a living, explains why. He says there is no money in Zimbabwe. That is why many Zimbabweans come to South Africa to find means of survival. He says no one forces others into these illegal mines, but these Zimbabweans do it to survive. Temba Moroka, a resident of Kuma Township just outside Stilfontein, says the government must stop arresting people and instead give them licenses to work in these abandoned mines.
Actually, if government can assist on that regard, I think we'll grab that opportunity to say, nah, we will register and do it legally.
Police have said that on Friday, they received a note from the miners saying there are about 500 illegal miners underground and 300 of them are very sick. However, the government says the plan to rescue the miners safely requires thorough planning to ensure nothing goes wrong. For VOA News in Stilfontein, Northwest Province of South Africa, I am Tuso Kumalo.
You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. We'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. We may share your comments on African News Tonight. The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Karim Kahan, has said the court has collected more than 1,300 pieces of evidence about war crimes and human rights violations in Libya. Khan said in his briefing to the Security Council that the court has issued 4 public arrest warrants regarding these crimes, and there is 1 public arrest warrant pending regarding the crimes of 2011, which is the warrant for Saif al-Islam Gaddafi. Wolfgang Poschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi.
I would say from all of these warrants, this one is the most important one. Khan explained that they found new evidence. evidence for the involvement of Saif al-Islam in war crimes during the revolution. Quite interesting, Khan previously served as the defense lawyer for Saif at the ICC, but he stopped doing so when he became the lead attorney general. Upholding this warrant has a huge political impact in Libya, especially as the number of Saif supporters is increasing by the day. Saif intends to run for presidency at the next presidential elections, if they ever happen. But it is doubtful that he will be allowed to do so. If the arrest warrant would be lifted, this would have been a strong boost for him. But now it's probably different. Saif was detained by the Sintanis in the south of Libya on the way to Niger in October 2011 and subsequently held captured in Sintan, used as a bargain chip for increasing the influence of the Sintanis in Tripoli, which worked until 2014, the outbreak of the civil war. He was sentenced to death by a court in Tripoli in 2015 in absentia, but later on the case was referred back to the court of first instance for further review and retrial. In June 2017, he was freed by the Sintanis, and he spent most of the time thereafter in Sintan. He is a very polarizing figure, strongly rejected by the Misrata and many other cities in Tripolitania. Most of the former revolutionary fighters and the Islamists consider him still as their most important enemy. So if Saif is allowed to run for presidency and makes it into the runoff, this might very well lead to a new outbreak of violence in Libya.
Khan indicated in his briefing that he is in constant contact with eastern Libya and explained that his team continues to work on collecting evidence about the crimes committed during the period between 2014 and 2020, including extrajudicial killings, kidnapping, sexual violence, airstrikes, use of mines, and enforced disappearance. How could that impact General Haftar's forces, who began their military campaign toward Tripoli during that period?
Of course, I expect a thorough investigation into what happened during the Battle of Tripoli 2019-2020, including also, in addition, the shelling of civilian residential areas by artillery of the Libyan National Army. But this battle unfolded under the watchful eyes of the world, including many media, and is very well documented. Probably more significant would be that the ICC has in-depth investigations into the battles of Benghazi 2014 to 2017 and Derna 2018 to 2019, that were fought pretty much away from public attention. Especially the battle for Benghazi was a particular bloody fight between the Benghazi Revolutionary Shura Council and Haftar's Libyan National Army. The BRC included infamous terrorist groups like the Ansar al-Sharia and was supported by ISIS. The LNA suffered altogether about 5,000 killed. Civilians were often crossed and at times intentionally targeted by both sides. The BRC took only rarely prisoners, and if they did, most of them were tortured to death. One can imagine how LNA fighters reacted when they found the mutilated bodies of their comrades. So I would say lots of work to be done by the ICC, also in the East, but this might help the reconciliation process in Libya in the long run.
The U.S. Special Envoy to Libya, Ambassador Richard Norland, visited the city of Sabha, during which he met with a number of Libyan military officials and said that the meeting was to affirm U.S. shared commitment to supporting efforts made throughout the country to achieve long-term stability and prosperity. What do you make of that?
That's a very significant visit. The 2022 U.S. Strategy to Prevent Conflict and Promote Stability has identified five partner countries and regions, and Libya is one of them. The strategy is a joint effort by the U.S. government and partners in the region to address root causes of instability and build a durable, inclusive peace. The 10-year plan for Libya focuses on southern Libya, on Fezzan, and keeping the impact of the difficult situation in Fezzan on the whole region in mind. A focus on Fezzan certainly makes sense, and Norland's visit was the very first visit of a U.S. special envoy to SEPA and must be mainly seen in context with this strategy.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, the former military attaché in Libya for Austria. He was speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will soon have a new administrator, former lawmaker Lee Zeldin. has been nominated by President-elect Donald Trump for that role. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias looks at Zeldin's credentials and how the agency's priorities are expected to change, particularly when it comes to climate change regulations.
Lee Zeldin is a former four-term Republican congressman from New York State and a longtime supporter of President-elect Donald Trump. Zeldin is poised to become the next administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The 44-year-old holds a law degree from Albany Law School and served 4 years on active duty in the U.S. Army. He's married and has twin daughters. In a statement released on November 11th, Trump announced Zeldin's nomination, saying the former congressman will, quote, unleash the power of American businesses while at the same time maintaining the highest environmental standards. Zeldin told Fox News he's excited to implement Trump's economic agenda.
There are regulations that the left wing of this country have been advocating through regulatory power that ends up causing businesses to go in the wrong direction.
Under Democratic President Joe Biden's administration, the EPA has prioritized the production of clean and renewable power and put restrictions on oil and gas production in a bid to curb toxic emissions and fight climate change. President-elect Trump envisions a different formula.
We will blast through every bureaucratic hurdle to issue rapid approvals for new drilling, new pipelines, new refineries, new power plants, new electric plants, and reactors of all types.
Zeldin voiced similar positions when he unsuccessfully ran for governor of New York in 2022.
We should reverse the state's ban on the safe extraction of natural gas and approve new pipeline applications.
Zeldin's nomination comes as the United Nations renewed its call on countries to move away from fossil fuels to combat global warming.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
The sound you hear is the ticking clock. We are in the final countdown to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And time is not on our side.
Even as climate change regulations are expected to be scaled back at the federal level under Zeldin's leadership, analysts note that currently states can choose to enact their own regulations and consumers can individually opt for green solutions. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Interpol says it arrested 1,006 suspects in Africa during a two-month operation. The operation clamped down on cybercrime that has left tens of thousands of victims, including some who were trafficked and produced millions in financial damages. According to the Associated Press, the Global Police Organization says that Operation Serengeti, a joint operation with Afripol, ran from September 2nd to October 31st in 19 African countries. It targeted criminals behind ransomware, business email, compromise, digital extortion, and online scams. Interpol identified 35,000 victims during the operation, with cases linked to nearly $193 million in financial losses worldwide. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrias Rigas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.